You know, that hymn, it is true. God will see us through no matter what it is that we're going through, the issues that we're having to deal with in this country and, of course, throughout the world. And as things continue on, we will stand right through it all, and we will be there if we continue forward in the faith when that last trumpet calls. So, you know, the Feast of Trumpets is coming up shortly, and it will be here before we know it. And, you know, that, I guess, as we come upon it, I guess we ought to really think more about that, because it is true. I mean, all the different things that we've been concerned about, the things that have been happening around in the world, we know they're going to happen. We've been told they're going to happen, and we're told they're going to intensify as time goes on. If this isn't the time and the start of Jacob's trouble, then we need to be praying that God will grant us peace, that we will be able to have the opportunity to be able to get back together normally and spend time together, get back to, if you will, some type of normalcy and a normal schedule. But at the same time, always knowing that from what we've learned and what we've seen through all of this, that things can happen quickly. And God's plan, whenever it's time, it will happen. And it will happen suddenly. That's why God says, that's why Jesus Christ mentioned while he was here on the earth, that's why God inspired his prophets and his apostles to say, watch and be ready. So we need to be doing that. We need to be staying, if you will, on our spiritual toes. So it has nothing to do with my message today. I was just thinking about it as we were singing the hymn. Anyhow, just wanted to pass that along. For the past couple weeks now, and I don't know if the little ones here have had the opportunity to be a part of it, but we've been having what is called the virtual preteen camp. The virtual preteen camp, and it's been so far. It's been a great success. It's been wonderful to be able to be a part of it. The response has actually been quite overwhelming, and the children have been quite responsive in posting the videos of themselves. We're using a platform called Flipgrid. I know that some in the educational field, because of the remote learning and things, remote teaching, they're using this as a platform for the kids to be able to, and the teachers to be able to correspond back and forth. So that's the platform that we used. We actually tapped three members from the Nashville congregation that were teachers. We have Gordon Pennington and his wife Amber, which, you know, was Amber Duncan. So, and then Amy Duncan. Amber is a kindergarten teacher, and Gordon is he's an elementary school teacher. He's in the process of going for his master's to be able to be a physical education teacher. And that's what he enjoys. And then, of course, Amy is an art teacher. So we had them, we put those on the team, if you will, and we called it the, what did we call it? I forgot what we called it, dear. It was a team. The A team, yeah. No, wasn't that a show back in the 80s? Anyway, but the A team, I guess. No, it was, we called it the, it's going to come to me here in a little bit. Anyhow, it was a good team. I'll just put it that way. And they had a great input, and they were very good about giving it the great ideas and such. And then we tapped a friend of ours from Northwest Arkansas to coordinate, if you will, to make sure everybody was able to get all of their things done and together. And everything's worked out smoothly, and we give God the credit for that, because it's been an overwhelming success so far. So the children have participated. I believe over half of them have posted introduce yourself videos, and then we've responded to those videos. It's neat that how you're able to do that. And then, of course, all the different classes, from answering questions in regards to the Christian living, and then showing their artwork after class, and then taking on the challenges that Mr. Pennington, Gordon Pennington, challenged them in the fitness and games. And then, of course, the cooking classes that we've had, and we'll have this coming week, and camp song, camp dance, and you name it. They've been quite involved. It's been wonderful to see. And to see their involvement has actually been quite exciting. It's been exciting to see their excitement and being encouraged to have something when they weren't able to have camp. And I think that's wonderful. So, but this in no way takes the place of camp. In no way does it take the personal interaction You still have the interaction, but it's not the personal interaction, but it is a good substitute. It's a nice substitute for this year, considering the environment that we find ourselves in right now. And we're trying to make the best of it. We're trying to give what we can to help them. It was a lot of work to be able to put together, but it was well worth it. But all of the Christian living classes and all in the Sabbath teaching tools, the classes and the activities are based upon the theme of camp this year that we established back in November of last year. The camp team, when we met back in November, and that was, it is, firmly anchored, holding fast what is good. And there's a lot in that. We're going to kind of look at that here in a little bit. But for the past three Fridays, we've posted Christian living and a Sabbath activity. And those are the only things that we post on the Fridays. And they're able to then have the Christian living that they watch on the Sabbath, and they have the Sabbath activity that they're able to do after that, and then post videos of after they've done that. And then on the Sunday, and this Sunday, this coming Sunday, tomorrow is going to be the last week that we do this, but we've released the activities for the week. And so then they have the rest of the week to do all the activities. And it's really neat. There's been over, right now, well, I don't know what it, actually I could tell you what it is right now. I will tell you how many views that we've had, that people watching the videos and such. Let's see. I will tell you this. So far, 36,111 views, different views of the videos, of the classes and responses and such. So, but that's really neat, and it keeps climbing. But anyhow, they have that week then to do those. But so this Sunday will be the last that we have for the activities. But all the activities and classes are based upon this theme, and they intertwine them with the Christian living class as well for that particular week. So whatever Christian living was given, all the classes for that week intertwine, and they try to then build on that Christian living class, which is, I think, a wonderful thing. And everyone that has put those classes together and the activities done just an amazing job. It's been on my mind a lot, and I just I wanted to share that with you. But in the reason that I bring it up is because actually my message is actually taken from part of the theme that we established for camp this year, which was, as I said a second ago, firmly anchored, holding fast what is good. And so after putting a Christian living together myself, and then listening to the other Christian living messages, and then looking at and watching the activities and all the different lessons and responses and replies from the kids. And that they do. They respond and we reply. But one word in the theme kept coming to my mind, just kept coming to mind. And I kept asking myself how I would more deeply explain this one particular word, which actually encompasses most of it, and what it is that we're saying would be firmly anchored to, and how would I answer if I was asked. So I'd been thinking about it, and as I drive, I think about it, and such. I do a lot of thinking when I drive, and sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad, sometimes it's dangerous. But after reading an article, actually, Thursday, it was on Fox News, and it was actually an opinion piece by Lauren Green. And it was actually published Tuesday, the 21st. And I thought to myself when I read it how confused one could become by justifying this particular word to fit their own thinking. So the article was titled, Can You Be Moral Without Believing in God? Can you be moral without believing in God? And the opening line in the article presented a question, and it was this, and I quote, Is belief in God necessary in order to have good values? Is belief in God necessary in order to have good values? Well, then the very next statement that was made in the article begins to explain, if you will, to answer this question, along with some more explanation that went along within the remainder of the article. But I quote, and it's a doctor, his name is Dr. Wolf, V-O-L-F, of the Yale Divinity School, says, yes. He says, I think it is possible to be moral and not believe in God. I say that as a Christian and as a Christian theologian, I know a lot of people who do, end quote. And I read the remainder of the article, yes, they had different positions on it, but in the end of it, pretty much, it was that of what he said at the beginning. That, is it, but he says it's because of different religions, you know, we have to take all that into the equation and such, but he says he knows a lot of people that are moral but yet don't believe in God. So the doctor, I mean, just pretty much says that you can be moral and not believe in God. Is this true? Is that true? Well, moral is defined as what? Well, moral is defined as someone, and this is a definition from, I took it from dictionary.com. You can go to Merriam-Webster's, it's about the same. But this one just kind of explained it a little easier. It says, moral is defined as someone that is concerned with principles of right and wrong behavior and the goodness or badness of human character. Remember that definition. So in other words, what we see is that the doctor said that someone can be good, they can be good and not believe in God. Do you believe that? Because remember, what is the theme for camp? Firmly anchored, holding fast what is good. Holding fast what is good. Well, this actually, after reading this and thinking about it, made me go back and study this word that's used as part of the theme for camp this year. And I had personally felt needed further examination. And that word is good. Good. The word is good. Can we be good if we are not firmly anchored in what is good? Well, to understand this, we must look at what God says to us, what he shows us in his word about this word good, about what is good, and then see what God says is good. So if you want a title for the sermon, I do actually have a title today, and it is simple. What is good? What is good? So to start off, I would like to go through and discuss briefly a number of scriptures. And these scriptures, they discuss and they bring out the word good. And I want to put it into that context. Let's start off in Romans 12. Let's go to Romans 12. We're going to go through these. I'll maybe have just a little bit of commentary, if you will, after we read them. But I do have a few, but I want them to all lead to a point. And that's my hope, is to be able to lead to a point. Romans 12 and verse 9. And just one verse here. Just one verse. You can go on reading, and it explains, you know, what he's talking about here. And maybe we'll come back, if we have time, back to Romans 12. But Romans 12, verse 9, it says, let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good. Cling to what is good. We see here that we are to cling to what is good. Well, what does that even mean? What does it mean to cling to what is good? Well, the Greek word for cling literally means to stick, to glue, to keep company. If you stick and you glue something, how close are you to that? Right up against it, right? To stick, to glue, to join, to keep company. So this is telling us that we are to be stuck like glue and keep company to what is good. So we can't be separated from it. That's what it's telling us. And the word good in the Greek, and this is this particular word in all the passages that we'll go to, is the same word. It's called agatho. The Greek word for good is agathos. Agathos. A-G-A-T-H-O-S. Which means good thing, that which is good, something of benefit, useful, upright, and acceptable. A good thing, that which is good, something of benefit, useful, upright, and acceptable. So, as Paul says here, if we are to be stuck like glue and keep company with the things of benefit, the things that are useful, things that are upright, and things that are acceptable. It's exactly what the theme from camp explains, to hold on to what is good. So cling to that. Let's go to Romans 16. We're right here in Romans. Romans 16, one verse here as well. Verse 19. For your obedience has become known to all. Therefore, I am glad on your behalf. And you notice he says your obedience is known to all. But I want you to be wise in what is good. I want you to be wise in what is good. And I want you to be simple concerning evil. And that word simple literally means innocent. I want you to be innocent in what is evil. Paul's actually telling the church in Rome, just as he was in Rome back in Romans 12, that they are to be wise in what is good. So the word wise here actually means to be skilled, to be an expert, to be learned, to have understanding. So we must be skilled, learned, and have understanding in what is good. That's what he's saying. He says, be skilled and learned and know what is good, but be innocent in what is evil. And how would you be innocent in what is evil? If you stay away from it. if you're not doing it. It's pretty simple if you think about it. Let's go to 1 Thessalonians 5. 1 Thessalonians 5. As I said, we've got a few passages that we'll go to. In 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 15, the Apostle Paul once again says, "See that no one renders evil for evil." Wait a minute. He even said this here back in Romans, "Be innocent of what is evil." It says, "See that no one renders evil for evil to anyone, but always pursue what is good, both for yourselves and for all." Pursue what is good for yourselves and for all. In the King James Version, in this passage, it's translated, it says, "See that none render evil for evil unto any man." And if that man actually means any person, whether it be male, female, doesn't matter. "But ever follow," he says, "but ever follow that which is good, both among yourselves and to all." We are to ever follow, always pursue, as it says in the New King James Version. But the King James, ever follow. And that particular, the Greek word for this particular phrase, ever follow, means to give, to press forward, to run after, to seek eagerly that which is good. To run after, to seek eagerly, to press forward that which is good. And that which is good is translated from the same word, agathos. Those things of benefit that are upright, useful, and acceptable towards all men. That's what we're to run after, to seek eagerly. Titus 1. Titus 1, and we'll start in verse 7. Verse 7. Here Paul is explaining to the minister Titus how to, if you will, look at the qualifications for those who he's looking at to, because Paul told them to go and ordain men who would be fit for the position. And he's saying, this is what you look for. He says, "For a bishop must be blameless, as a steward of God, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but hospitable, a lover of what is good, sober-minded, just, holy." And he says, self-control. But right in the middle, he says, a lover of what is good. A lover of what is good. Well, this phrase, lover of what is good, is actually a combination of two words. It's a combination of the word that we use for love. Remember, we use agape, but we also use philia, don't we? P-H-I-L-O. So it is actually a combination between philios and agathos. And it is Philo-agathos is the word, and it means fond to do good, promoter of virtue. What is virtue? Righteousness or morality or integrity. So what Paul was telling Titus, he was saying, make sure that before you ordain this particular individual, make sure that he is one who is friendly and has compassion. And he does things that God expects, those things of righteousness, morality, and integrity. 1 Peter 3. Like I said, we'll get to a point. I'm trying to bring this to a point. And as we go along, just follow along with me. 1 Peter 3, verse 13. 1 Peter 3, verse 13. He says, "And who is he who will harm you if you become followers of what is good?" And who is he who will harm you if you become followers of what is good? We are to be followers of what is good. Followers. The word follower literally means to be an imitator. That's what that word means, imitator. We are to be imitators of what? What is good. That's what he says. That which is of benefit. That which is useful, upright, and acceptable. But now I want to add a question on the end of that. To who? To who? Well, we've already read all men, right? But let's keep digging. 3 John, verse 1, chapter 1. 3 John, chapter 1. We don't go to 3 John much. 3 John, chapter 1, and I want to read verse 11. 3 John, chapter 1, verse 11. "Beloved, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. He who does good is of God, but he who does evil has not seen God." He says he has not seen God. Once again, we see that we are to be imitators. Same word as was used back in 1 Peter 3, verse 13. It says imitators of what is good. But this passage goes further. It shows us a little more, and it gets to the crux of where we're going to go today. He, she, any person that does good, says, is of God. It says right here. Who does good is of God. But that person does not do evil. The person who does evil, it says, has not seen God. And that particular word for seen is harao. And it means to see. To see with the eyes, to discern, to perceive, to take heed. Wait a second. What has God done to us so we know who He is? He's opened our eyes, hasn't He? Spiritually speaking. He's opened our eyes. So here we see what John is saying. He's saying, but he who does evil, his eyes haven't been opened. God has not opened their eyes. And this particular passage right here actually gets quickly to the point. Quickly to the point. Good is only of God. Period. Good is only of God. Satan has deceived the world to believe you can be both good and evil. That is why the tree is called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Because they mix the two. They mix the two. But God tells us it is one or the other. It is one or the other. You can't be good and live a life contrary to God's way. You can't. It is impossible. Oh, you can live a life of good and evil. All right, that's right. But you're not living God's way of life. You're not. Good, as we will see, is only from and of God. It is only from and of God. You know, because many times we hear, well, they're good people. Yeah, they're good people. But they're blinded to the fact of what is good, what is right, and what is true. They still mix good and evil. It is the tree that the world has been taking from since the beginning of time, since Adam and Eve. And it has been Satan who has deceived them to feel that it is okay. So I want to bring out what is good. Because whenever you have that in the theme for camp, firmly anchored, holding fast to what is good, for many that would look at that, well, that person's good and the things they do are good, I can hold on to that. No, we have to understand what good is. What good is? Let's go to Matthew 19. Matthew 19. Matthew 19, verse 16. Matthew 19, verse 16. We'll start here in verse 16. It says, "Now behold, one came and said to him, 'Good teacher, what good thing shall I do that I may have eternal life?' So he said to him, 'Why do you call me good?'" And this is Jesus Christ talking now. He says, "Why do you call me good? No one is good but one, that is God. But if you want to enter into life, keep the commandments." Why would Jesus Christ say, why would he say, "Why do you call me good?" Was Jesus Christ good? Was he? Well, I would say yes. If he wasn't, could he have died for us? No. I would say no. So why did he say this? Well, I'll tell you why he said this. He knew where this young ruler, or this young man, was coming from. He was looking at it as Jesus Christ as a mere man. That's what he was looking at. He didn't believe that, he thought maybe he was a prophet, but he didn't believe he was the Son of God. No need to argue with him. So he says, "Why do you call me good? You're trying to, in a way, add a label to me, and you think I'm a man, and you're trying to, if you will, butter me up." And he knew that. Jesus Christ is no dummy. So that's why he said what he said. But he says, if you want to enter into life, keep the commandments. But he does say right before that, he says, "No one is good but one, that is God." Very, 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 very straight to the point. There is one, and that is God. And he goes on to say, "But if you want to enter into life, keep the commandments." And he says, "Well, which ones?" Jesus said, "You should not murder, you should not commit adultery, you should not steal, you should not bear false witness, honor your father and mother, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself." Then he goes on to say, the young man said to him, "All these things I've have." You notice what he left out of there? "You shall not covet." You notice he left that out of there? But if you're going to love your neighbors yourself, you're not going to do that anyway. But he knew what this rich, he knew he's a rich young ruler, and he knew where his mind was. And so he let him answer. The young man said, "All these things I've kept from my youth. What do I still lack?" And he goes on to say, Jesus said to him, "If you want to be complete, go sell what you have, give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come and follow me." He says, "But the young man heard the saying, he went away sorrowful because he had great possessions." Great possessions. What is being said here is that only through God can we become good. Only through God can we become good. If we want to enter into life, we must live how God lives, how God desires us to live. We must be willing to love, it says, our neighbor as ourself. And we must be willing to give up everything. Everything. To give up everything. And everything is a strong word because everything is inclusive of everything. It consists of all we have and all we are. We're to do that, to give up everything for God and to love Him more than life itself. Anything that life can present it, can present to us. To one day become good, if you will. We must first live good. Have you ever thought about that? To become good, we must first live good. To become like God, we must first live like God. You know, the Apostle Paul understood that. Let's go back to Romans 7. Romans 7, and we'll just read actually two verses here. Romans 7, verse 18. Romans 7, verse 18, Paul says, "For I know that in me, that is my flesh, his human nature, his carnal mind, nothing good dwells. Nothing good dwells. For to will is present with me, and how to perform what is good, I myself don't find. For the good that I will to do, that I don't do. But the evil I will not to do, that I practice." He knew that of and by himself, and if you want to change that over, by ourselves, talking about us, in our flesh, our own thinking, nothing good dwells. Nothing good dwells. Of and by ourselves, without God's help, and we know, and that help comes through His Spirit, we do not find what is good. We do not know what is truly good. But once God begins to work with us, once He starts to work with us and to call us, if you will, to Jesus Christ, and then we make that decision to change and to commit our lives, ourselves, over to good works and that good and right way of life forever, I might add, forever, God forgives us and then gives us His Spirit as a helper to understand and to know how to do good. To know how to do good. Let's go to 1 John 3. Let's pick it up in verse 1. 1 John 3 and verse 1. "Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called the children of God. Therefore, the world does not know us, because it did not know God. Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when He is revealed, we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is. And everyone who has this hope in Him purifies himself just as He is pure." He says, "Whoever commits sin also commits lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness. And you know that He was manifested," Jesus Christ was manifested, "to take away our sins, and in Him," it says, "there is no sin." Why? Because Jesus Christ was perfect and He was blameless. It goes on to say, "Whoever abides in Him does not sin." Really? "Whoever sins has neither seen Him nor known Him." What does this mean? Whoever abides in Him does not sin. Do you still sin? And do you abide in Jesus Christ? Hell, we do. What does that mean? Well, it means that we will not remain in sin. It means that we're making a change. It means that we're changing our life and we're striving to do what is good. striving to do what is good. And goes on to say, little children, let no one deceive you at all. He who practices righteousness is righteous, just as Jesus Christ and the Father is righteous. He who sins, it says, is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. For this particular purpose, the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil. And he will, in time, fully. It goes on to say, whoever has been born of God does not sin. That same passage, that same phrase again. So in other words, whoever has been born of God does not remain in sin, does not practice sin, is changing. It's made a change. He says, for his seed, God's seed, remains in him. What is that seed? It's a spirit. And what is that spirit doing within us? It's growing. Just as you would a small, like a in the womb of a child, it's growing. From a seed, if you will. And he goes on to say, for his seed remains in him, and he cannot sin because he has been born of God. Well, it's this translation is not correct, if you will, because the Greek word for here, this particular Greek word, does not really mean cannot. It actually means we are enabled, we are empowered not to sin. We're given the power not to sin. That's what God has given us. To prick our minds, to say, hey, they didn't write. And we have the opportunity, of course, whenever we see what we do, to go before God. But right here in this particular set of verses 1 through 9, we see that anyone that does not practice righteousness, and what is righteousness? Living in a way that is pleasing to God. That's what righteousness is. And how is that? How do we live righteously? Well, we strive to imitate God, our Father in heaven, and our elder brother Jesus Christ, striving to imitate what is good. What is good? Paul goes on to say that those who don't, he says they're not righteous, and they are of their father, the devil. I think that's pretty strong words. But it's not me that says that. That is God that inspired it to be written. It's God's own words. This word is living and breathing. It is living, if you will, because they are for our life, and they are for our good. Go on to verse 10. It says, in this, the children of God and the children of the devil are their manifest. There's a difference. They're not the same. You know, who does it say is under the sway of the wicked one? The whole world. I mean, we can negate that if we want, but it is what it is. The whole world is under the sway of the wicked one. And he goes on, he says, whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is he who does not love his brother. So whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, period. It's right there. Not my words, like again, I'll reiterate that, but God's. So we see that what is good is of God, and to do good and to live good lives, we must follow God. We must follow God. This totally debunks the theory that one can be truly good and not believe in God. How are you moral if you do not believe in God? So we are to hold on to the things of God, his truth, his words, his way of life, all that he is. And that is good. We are to desire to imitate God's goodness in every aspect of our lives. So how can we sum this all up? How can we sum it all up? And what does good, I mean, we've already kind of painted a little bit of a picture, but what does good look like? What does good look like? Because remember, what is good, we are to keep firm hold of, no matter the circumstance in our lives, no matter the environment of the society that we're in, no matter the insults that come our way, the hardships that we endure, and the discomforts and disagreements of life. I submit to you, we are to do good. And I submit to you, there is one passage that sums it all up, sums what is good up. Let's go to Micah chapter 6, verse 8. Micah 6, verse 8, here God is pleading with Israel. And, you know, we're the spiritual house of Israel. And we are to pay attention to these words. He goes on to say in verse 8, he has shown you, O man, what is good. He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? He personalizes it here. But to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. God has shown, insert your name there. Insert your name, what is good. And if he has shown us what is good, then what does then God require of you? Insert your name there. He says to do justly, to love mercy. And he says, and walk humbly with your God. This is what is good, and this is what is required of us. Those of us who have been shown what is good, those of us who have been called to do good. So for the remainder of the message, I would like to briefly touch on these three things, and I encourage you to go back and continue your study in these three things because they encompass the entire Bible. To do justly, to love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. We'll just touch on them. The first one, to do justly. What does justly mean? The Hebrew word here is misphat, misphat, M-I-S-H-P-A-T. And it has to do with judgment, has to do with justice and ordinance. How do you even know how to judge, and how do you know how to do righteous judgment if you don't have an ordinance? You don't have the truth. You don't have a law, if you will. And God says that he will bring everything into judgment. So what will God bring into judgment? What will God bring into judgment? Ecclesiastes 12:14 says we're told by Solomon, it may not be Solomon that actually wrote this last couple, three or four verses within Ecclesiastes, but we're told God will bring every work into judgment. Every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether what? Good or evil. How will God base his judgment? Now, we've already kind of touched on that a little bit, but how will God base his judgment? How will he base that judgment? Let's go to Revelation 20. Revelation 20, because it tells us. Revelation 20 and verse 12. Here we're at the second resurrection. This is what this is talking about. Those who have never known God, they may have, I guess you could say they may have known about God, but they didn't know God. Revelation 20, verse 12, he says, "And I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God, and books were opened. And it says, another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged according to their works by the things which were written in the books." The first set of books that were opened. The other book was opened, the book of life. The book of life is open to give these people the opportunity to have their names written within that book. That's why it's opened. But the other books referenced here are the books of the Bible. Those will be opened up to them. They will then be given eyes to see. They'll be given eyes to see. God will open up their minds to understand the words of these books for the first time. And then at this time, they will have to choose between good and evil. For all these years, they've never had to choose. Now they'll choose between good and evil, between life and death. They'll have to choose either what is good or what is not. But right now, we who are baptized members of the family of God are being judged. We are today. Judgment begins at the house of God from the books that are opened. And the book of life has been opened up to us. And our names are written in that book. But they can be blotted out if we allow that to happen. If we decide not to do justly. Not to do justly. To do justly means that we will do what is honorable. We'll do what is truthful. We will do what is lawful. We will do what is proper, what is righteous, and what is fair. Let me go over that again. To do justly means that we will do what is honorable, what is truthful, what is lawful, what is proper, what is righteous, and what is fair. That encompasses everything in our life. We should stop and consider all that it encompasses. I would encourage you to take that list home and study it. I would. But all those things, break them down. What justly means. What are these things and what do they look like? That's the best way to do it when we do our study. Study these and then back them with Scripture. And look into how God intends us to do all of these things. How does God intend for us to do all of these things? You know, I could give you the answers right here. But our answers wouldn't be the same. It would come from the same word and the same law. But we've all got our own faults. We have to work through that ourselves. We have to know how to do justly. To do justly is based upon the law of God. But how all of this, all the rest of it comes out, and the things that we're to learn, will be different. All of us, it'll be different. Just remember, God practices perfect justice and perfect judgment. He is always honorable. He is always truthful. He does what is lawful. It is His law. He is always proper. He is always righteous. And He is always fair. Always. Couple that with your study as you go through it. That's all we'll touch on that one. Let's go to the second one, to love mercy. To love mercy. The Hebrew word for mercy literally means goodness, loving kindness, pity, or favor. That's what mercy means. How would you explain mercy? How would you explain mercy? Well, mercy would, I feel, would be best explained as kindness shown to someone when it is not deserved. That's how I would look at mercy. When there should actually be a penalty. That's hard to do, isn't it? You ever been put in that position? You ever been put in the position to where you have to show that you should show kindness at a time, maybe when it was undeserved? That's pretty powerful. You know, mercy is often tied to forgiveness. Mercy is when someone does something against you, but yet you forgive them. And I want to add, we need to stop right there and stop thinking about ourselves and go, wait a second, just as God has forgiven us. Just as God has forgiven us. Does this mean, or He will forgive us? I mean, if you think about it, it says the result of sin is death. We could have sinned and been gone just like that because we disobeyed His law. But no, He was merciful. He was merciful to us as He's been merciful to the world. He's given them time. He gave Israel time. He showed mercy to Israel. Time and again, if you can go back to Jonah, who did He show mercy to? Nineveh. And what did Jonah like about that? Absolutely nothing. You know, that is a sad set of scriptures, as far as I'm concerned. Because it ends knowing that Jonah is still upset. I don't see where Jonah said, I disagree. I agree with you, God. No, he was still frustrated that he didn't get to see fire and brimstone come down and annihilate the people. God was teaching Jonah mercy. That's what He's trying to teach them. That's what God wants to see in us. That's what He's trying to teach us. But does this mean that God pushes aside justice to allow for mercy? No. All he does is pause justice. Justice will come. It will always come. That's what we're told back in Romans 12, verse 19. Don't avenge yourselves. God is the one who does. Vengeance is His, not ours. Justice comes from God, not us. Because we don't have the ability for holy, righteous justice. Not yet. Not yet. We should all, of all people, know that God does not push aside justice just to allow for mercy. We should understand, because we've been taught, that God is patient. And what does He say? Back at 1 Peter, He says He doesn't wish that any should perish. I believe that's 2 Peter. He doesn't wish any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. I think that's 2 Peter 3, verse 9. I could be wrong. But God shows mercy when maybe we don't think we should. Have you ever thought about that? God shows mercy when we don't think we should. Like I said, think about the account of Jonah. You know, judgment comes in time. Why do you think God is going to have two resurrections? Well, he'll have three. Why will he have the first resurrection and the second resurrection? Because of that very reason. He doesn't wish that any should perish. And he's being patient with them. He's being merciful. God is merciful always. And as I said, though, but judgment will ultimately and eventually come to all, but to us first. You know, mercy is a part of God's very nature. And mercy, God actually pardons when he doesn't have to. He relents. He is kind, even when he shouldn't have to be, because he knows that we are fallible human beings. He knows. He created us. He understands that we're just dirt. Yes, we are created in his image. We're created in his image, but we're not perfect, and he understands that fully. But don't confuse mercy with grace, because they're not the same. They're not the same. Grace is much more extensive. It is, and mercy is actually an aspect of grace. Mercy is granted by God many times. Many times it's granted by God. Grace is a gift, and it's given once. We live under grace through and by the death of Jesus Christ. He gave his life. It was a gift so we could have life eternally. And through him, eternal salvation is promised. And I'll give a message soon on grace and the components that make up grace, maybe to help us understand that a little better. But right now, to simplify, grace is not something we can give. We can't give it. But mercy is. Grace we cannot. Only God is able to do that. But mercy we can give. And we are to imitate our Father in heaven. We are to love mercy. To love mercy. Let's go to Luke 6. Luke 6. Luke chapter 6. Actually, I wasn't going to turn there, but we'll just read it. Luke 6, verse 36. Luke 6, verse 36, one passage. It says, "Therefore be merciful, just as your Father also is merciful." We're told very, very, very plainly by Jesus Christ himself. Matthew 5, 7, you can go to what we've labeled as the Beatitudes. It says, "Blessed," back in Matthew 5, verse 7, "blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy." Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Then in Matthew 6, 12, where Jesus Christ gives us, if you will, the outline for prayer, what does he say? "Forgive me of my debts as I forgive my debtors." If you're to do that, you're being merciful. God wants to see if we're willing to yield to others, no matter if the other person does not. That we should yield even if the other person does not. You know, God has yielded for us. Think about that. God has been so merciful to us, and he wants us to do the same. He wants us to portray who he is. And that does portray who he is. Whenever someone has done something that something against you, but yet you forgive it and you let it go. Because we all should understand that God is the ultimate judge. God is the ultimate judge. Matthew 18. I do want to turn here. Matthew 18. Because this gives us an example. Matthew 18, verse 15. Matthew 18, verse 15. "Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. And if he hears you, you have gained your brother. But if he will not hear you, take with you one or two more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established. But if they don't, what are you supposed to do? Just don't forgive them and continue to hold it against them?" He says, "But if he will not," and "if he refuses to hear, tell it to the church. But if he refuses to hear the church, let him," he says, be like a heathen and tax collector. But even if you're to think of them that way, do you hold the grudge? What do you do? "Surely I say to you, whatever will be bound on earth will be bound in heaven." And he goes on to say, "Whatever will be loosed on earth will be loosed in heaven." And he goes on, he says, and I say to you, if you agree on earth concerning anything that I ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered together is my name. I meant to start in verse 21, but that's okay. That just shows us right there, reading verse 15 through 18 or through 17, that, you know, yes, there is something that a brother maybe has done against us or sinned against us, and we go and we tell them the fault, their fault, but yet they say, you know what, I'm not going to forgive you, or I'm not going to ask for forgiveness. I'm not wrong. What is our part in it? They've sinned against us. Here's where I wanted to get. Verse 21, then Peter came to him and said, Lord, Then Peter came to him and said, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to seven times? And Jesus said, I do not say up to you seven times, but 70 times seven. I mean, he's saying, always forgive them. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king, and he goes into a parable, and we'll read it here real quick, who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. And when he began to settle accounts, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. That is a lot of money. And he goes on to say, but as he was not able to pay, his master commanded that he be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and the payment be made. The servant therefore fell down before him, saying, Master, have patience with me. I will pay you all. What did the master have in his power right then and there to do? Say, nope, you owe it to me. You can put ourselves in that particular place with God. We've sinned against God, right? We had every right to say, nope, you sinned against me. You've got to pay the penalty. But he didn't. And in this parable, he goes on to say, but as he was not able to pay, his master sold him, but then his servant fell down, and then the master of that servant was moved, it says, with compassion, and released him. And that word compassion means mercy. He was moved with mercy. And he says, and forgave him the debt. He says, but that servant went out after he was forgiven that debt, that major debt that he had against his master. He went out, he says, and found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii, which is nothing in comparison to 10,000 talents. And he goes on to say, and he laid hands on him and took him by the throat, saying, pay me what you owe. So his fellow servant fell down at his feet and begged him, saying, have patience with me, and I will pay you all. That's what the servant just did to the master. And if you think about it, what God is telling us here, Jesus Christ is explaining through this parable, is mercy. Usually parables are to show us one thing. There's other lessons that we can take out of it, but most of them show us one thing. They're showing mercy. And what he's trying to get at is, doesn't matter what anybody else can do to you, it is nothing in comparison to what you've done to me that I have forgiven. That I have been merciful. And he's saying there's nothing anybody can do to you that was as bad. That's what he's getting at. And so his fellow servant fell down. He did the same thing that he did, but he said he would not. And he threw him into prison until he should pay the debt. And when his fellow servants saw what had been done, they were grieved and came and told their master all that had been done. The master, after he called him, said, you wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you begged me. Should you not also have had compassion on your fellow servant just as I had pity on you? I had mercy on you, but you didn't have mercy on anyone else. To be merciful may hurt sometimes. It may hurt, and it may be uncomfortable, and it may require that we forgive our brother time and time and time again at even our expense. And that's not easy to do. To show mercy or to not show mercy actually reveals something very important. It reveals our character, and it reveals our heart. Because that's what our character is based out of. We may feel justice is deserved because we have been violated, and the individual that did so should face the consequences. You know, to be honest with you, this is us trying to avenge ourselves every time, trying to justify their consequence, when in fact we should be showing mercy, even if mercy is not shown to us. We are to love our enemies, not get even with them. Oh boy, that's hard to do. Jesus Christ did it, and we're to do the same. And to do this takes the last item we'll look at, and that is to walk humbly with your God. To walk humbly with your God, and this is a hard one. This is a hard one because this is saying that we understand who God is. That's what it says, that we understand who God is. If we're going to walk humbly with him, we understand who he is. Okay, that's easy, right? To understand who he is, you can look up in the sky and you can see the stars at night. You can see the moon. You can see the flowers that grow, and you can see the birds that frolic and the sea as it crashes on the shore and all this life that teems within the sea. Yeah, God made that. Absolutely, I believe that. That's easy. God is God and he's able to do anything. I understand that. And there's nothing too hard for him. He can speak and it exists, or it will happen, whatever. God is all powerful. There's nothing else that is like God our Father and Jesus Christ, correct? Well, absolutely. Absolutely. But let's put it into perspective. God has created you, and we've already touched on this, you, and I want to put us individually in this. He has created you in his image. He has given you life. He has chosen you to be part of his family. He has given Jesus Christ all power and authority and allowed you to become heirs with his son. And now he has commissioned you to do justly and love mercy. Kind of changes it a little bit here. Wait a second. God has required all of this of me. To walk humbly with God means that we surrender to do the things that he has commanded. We surrender to do the things he has commanded you to do. Let's go to Luke 18. Luke 18. Explain this just a little better. Luke 18. Luke 18. Makes you feel very small if you think about it. Luke 18, verse 17. Assuredly I say to you, individualized, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God as a little child will by no means enter it. This passage has a lot of meaning because the word receive literally means to take hold of, to take up, to accept. So we are to take hold of what? Surely I say to you, whoever does not take hold of the kingdom of God as a little child will by no means enter it, will not accept it. To take, if you will, if you want to think about it in this manner, who has called you? The Father, right? He has called you to his Son, Jesus Christ, and through him we have access to the Father. If you take hold of, you take up, you accept the kingdom of God, who are you under? Who are you under? Who controls you, if I should say? God, the Father. And if you want to also put it in a little bit more simple terms, think about a parent and a child. A parent and a child. A child will, when a parent tells them to do something, come with me. What will the child usually do? Grab their hand and walk with their parent. You guys though have had children, you know. And if they kick and scream, what do? Well, you have to discipline them. But when a child is what Jesus Christ is talking about here, having that attitude of a child, whenever you say, come with me, you grab a hold of the parent, the little child grabs a hold of the parent's hand, and he goes with the parent. Whenever we submit to God, and God has told us to do something, in a way you can say that we take hold of the Father's hand to go do as he pleases for us to do. We do what is good. Because this is what our Father requires and desires of us, to walk humbly with our God. To take up his hand, if you will, and walk humbly with him. to be able to do justly and love mercy and all these things that all that justly to do justly and to love mercy command and imply, humility must first be present. All these things must be present in us to live a good life. To live a good life. If this is our life, then one day we will be resurrected good. Because there is no one good but God. And it says that we will see him as he is. We will be good just as our Father in heaven is good, for we shall be like him. But first in this life, we must be doing good. We must be doing good, and to do good, we must hold on to what is good, firmly anchored in what our Father and Elder Brother Jesus Christ are all about. Be firmly anchored in them, always holding fast what is good, because if we are not holding on to what is good, we do not know God.